Welcome to the Deep Dive. Our mission here is to take a stack of compelling sources, tear them apart, and bring you the most essential, surprising nuggets of knowledge. Today, we are undertaking, well, a monumental task, dismantling centuries of entrenched medical dogma.
That dogma being the idea of the hardwired brain, the belief that after early childhood, the brain is a fixed machine, unchangeable, and if something breaks, you're essentially, well, out of luck. This idea constrained both medicine and, you know, our understanding of human potential for far too long.
Right. And our source material today, drawn from Norman Doidge's revolutionary work, proves that idea is definitively a myth. We are diving deep into neuroplasticity, the brain's stunning lifelong ability to reorganize, rewire, and even heal its own structure.
And that answers one of the most fundamental human questions. To what extent can we truly change? Can we recover from catastrophic brain damage, overcome deeply rooted disabilities, or alter destructive ingrained habits? This research suggests the potential is far greater than anyone imagined, because the brain is constantly revising itself.
Our guide through this landscape is Dr. Norman Doidge, a fascinating figure who bridges the world of clinical psychiatry and hard research. He doesn't just present the data, he acts as a translator, showing us the incredible, deeply human stories behind the discoveries.
Exactly. He transforms cold scientific facts like cortical maps and synaptic density into narratives of hope, showing how patients who were given up for lost used this science to redesign their lives. He proves that the concept of a fixed self, based on fixed biology, is simply wrong.
Okay, let's break down the core concept simply. If the brain isn't static hardware, what is it?
It's a dynamic, living system, perpetually under construction. And the mechanism driving this change is the synapse, that tiny gap where two neurons meet. The bedrock rule is famously known as the Hebbian theory. Neurons that fire together, wire together.
That sounds simple enough, but what does that actually mean structurally, you know, for the listener?
It means that every time you think a thought, perform an action, or recall a memory, a specific circuit lights up. The more often those specific neurons fire sequentially, the stronger and more efficient that synaptic connection becomes. Think of it like a dirt road. Every time you drive down it, you pave it a little more, making it easier and faster to drive down next time. That is the physical basis of learning and habit formation.
Okay, that mechanism makes sense for learning a new language or a skill. But can a brain actually reroute major functions? I mean, where's the real-world proof-of-concept evidence that this system is that flexible?
That takes us right to the incredible story of Cheryl Schultz. She experienced a medical tragedy. A course of antibiotics completely destroyed her vestibular system, her internal mechanism for balance. She was functionally blind and perpetually dizzy, unable to walk without falling. Traditional medicine offered her nothing.
Oh, that's terrifying.
It is. But pioneering scientist Paul Baccarita believed her brain could adapt. He developed a sensory substitution device. It took balance information from a sensor, and rather than routing it to the damaged inner ear, it translated the signal into complex electrical pulses delivered to, wait for it, her tongue.
Her tongue. That is wild, seriously.
It is. By concentrating on these specific pulse patterns, she learned to interpret them as information about her orientation in space. And here is the profound insight. Her brain's sensory area, previously dedicated solely to her tongue's function, began to process balance information instead.
So the brain's map of reality is temporary, dictated entirely by focused input, not by some rigid anatomical constraint.
Precisely. The brain doesn't care where the signal comes from, only that it is consistent, meaningful, and crucially focused. She eventually regained her balance even when the device was turned off because her brain had permanently repurposed that sensory area.
Wow. The Schultz case shows us the map can be redrawn, but the next area of research shows that this redrawing process is, well, a constant ruthless competition for resources. They call it competitive plasticity, right?
That's it. This is based on the groundbreaking work of researcher Michael Mertznich, who meticulously mapped the sensory cortex. He proved that brain real estate is not assigned for life. It is constantly being reallocated based on the use it or lose it principle.
So if I stop playing the guitar something that takes up, you know, a large chunk of my motor cortex, those neural pathways aren't just weakening. Another skill, say scrolling endlessly on my phone, is actually moving in and stealing that bandwidth. Is that how it works?
That's the perfect analogy, exactly. When Mertznich trained animals to use one specific finger intensely, the area of the brain map dedicated to that finger expanded dramatically, encroaching on the territory of neighboring fingers. Conversely, if you neglect a function, that brain real estate shrinks, and the neighboring, more active functions colonize it. The brain is competitive. Skills you use grow. Skills you neglect shrink.
This principle makes the story of Barbara Arrowsmith Young even more inspiring. She was born with multiple severe learning disabilities, struggling profoundly with conceptual reasoning, telling time, spatial awareness. She was told to simply accept her cognitive limitations.
But drawing on early Russian neuropsychology, she realized her brain wasn't broken. It just had specific, severely underdeveloped circuits. She refused to accept her fate, recognizing that if brain maps can change, well, why couldn't she direct that change?
The idea that we can self-direct our own brain's evolution, it sounds like a massive self-help promise. But what does Doige say about the time commitment? This wasn't a quick fix, was it?
Oh, far from it. This required intense, repetitive, highly specific exercises designed to activate her exact weak points. For example, to address her trouble with conceptual reasoning, she created exercises using complex, multi-handed clocks that forced her brain to integrate multiple streams of spatial and numerical information simultaneously. It was hard work.
She was essentially forcing those weak circuits to fire and wire together through sheer targeted effort.
Yes. She literally built herself a better brain and went on to found a global network of schools based on these methods. It demonstrates incredible agency, showing you can identify specific neural deficiencies and actually address them with focused work.
That's an amazing source of hope, but I assume there's a catch. If the brain is this flexible, doesn't that make it vulnerable too?
It does. Plasticity is neutral. It works for us when we learn a language, sure. But Doige emphasizes it can also create plasticity gone wrong.
Mm.
It's the very flexibility that allows destructive patterns to become deeply entrenched.
Can you give us an example of how a flexible brain can work against us? Like, how does that happen?
Well, consider chronic pain or addiction. If you constantly seek novelty or dopamine hits, say, through constantly checking social media, you are paving an incredibly efficient highway in your reward system, making those maladaptive loops highly automatic. In chronic pain, even after the physical injury heals, the nervous system has learned the pain signal so efficiently that the brain continues to fire the pain pathway, creating an entrenched, learned map of suffering.
So the brain's attempt to be efficient by strengthening a pathway can ultimately be its downfall. Wow. But the sources offer a way back, which is where Edward Taub's constraint-induced movement therapy, or CI therapy, comes in for stroke victims.
Right. CI therapy targets the concept of learned non-use. After a stroke, a patient might have residual function in the affected limb. But because it's painful or difficult to move, the brain makes a decision, often unconsciously, that the effort just isn't worth it. This leaves the patient to simply neglect the limb.
And what happens to the brain map when they neglect it then, based on what you said earlier?
Competitive plasticity steps in. Exactly. Since that limb is no longer speaking to the brain, the neural real estate dedicated to it shrinks and is taken over by the healthy, active parts of the body. The patient becomes worse over time, not necessarily because of the initial stroke damage, but because they learn not to use the limb.
So Taub's therapy forces them to unlearn that non-use. It sounds intense.
Precisely. CI therapy is intensive and almost brutally simple. Force the use of the paralyzed limb for many hours a day, often by restraining the good limb. This intense, focused repetition triggers the brain to remap motor control. It forces the neglected neural circuits to fire and wire together again, often restoring function, even in patients who were paralyzed for years.
Okay, here's where it gets truly fascinating for me, because the ultimate theme Doige lands on moves beyond physical repetition and into the realm of pure thought. If repetition works physically, does repetition of thought work?
Absolutely. Look at Jeffrey Schwartz's method for obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. OCD is a classic case of plasticity gone wrong, where the brain's worry circuit is basically stuck in overdrive. Schwartz taught patients a purely mental exercise designed to weaken those toxic obsessive pathways.
Walk us through those four steps again. How did that work?
It's intense cognitive work. Step one, relabel the intrusive thought as what it is, a symptom of a medical condition, OCD. Step two, reattribute it to a faulty signal in the brain. It's not you, it's your brain wiring misfiring. That's key. Step three, refocus your attention onto something constructive, something else entirely, for at least 15 minutes. And step four, revalue the obsession. Consciously decide it's worthless. It's just noise.
They were changing their actual physical brain structure just by shifting their attention and their belief about the signal. That is profound.
And the brain scans proved it. This purely mental exercise demonstrably weakened the old obsessive pathways and strengthened new, healthier circuits. It is definitive proof that focused, sustained attention sculpts our physical hardware, often without a single physical movement required.
We see that confirmed again in Alvaro Pasqualioni's famous piano experiment, right?
Yes, exactly. Two groups learning a complex piano exercise. One group physically practiced for hours. The other group only imagined practicing it, just thought about it. The brain scans revealed similar, significant structural changes in the motor cortex areas controlling the fingers for both groups. Visualization strengthened the neural pathways almost as effectively as physical practice.
That has massive implications for athletes, musicians, and frankly, anyone trying to gain a skill. You can actually train your brain without the physical act itself.
Which leads us back to mental health. If pure thought can reshape the motor cortex, it argues that psychoanalysis and talk therapy are fundamentally neuroplastic treatments. When you discuss a trauma, for instance, you are activating those rigid neural circuits associated with it.
But with the help of the therapist, you're creating new responses, new narratives around it, which is the act of rewiring, isn't it?
Exactly. You are actively weakening the automatic rigid traumatic pathways and building new flexible adaptive ones. Deutsch calls this process transforming painful ghosts into ancestors, turning a traumatic memory from a constant paralyzing automatic presence into, well, a piece of history that offers perspective without triggering the same intensity.
Okay, let's try and synthesize this a bit. The overall message here seems to be one of empowerment and agency. We are not passive inheritors of our brain anatomy. We are active, ongoing sculptors of its development, based fundamentally on what we choose to focus our sustained attention on and what we choose to practice. Is that fair?
Absolutely. And crucially, this debunks the myth of inevitable steep cognitive decline as we age. The brain remains plastic throughout life. Lifelong learning, novel challenges, physical activity, these aren't optional extras. They're essential maintenance activities. They stimulate the growth of new connections and even neurogenesis, the growth of new neurons. The key is to keep demanding novelty and focused effort from your brain to prevent that sort of atrophy.
That is a tremendously hopeful takeaway. So for everyone listening, if focus, attention, and effort physically sculpt your brain, and we know that competition is always fierce for neural real estate, what specific new sustained practice will you introduce this week to consciously direct your own neural evolution? What demanding new focus will actively manage the future shape of your mind?